like to remind people at the start of a program like this, there's lots of stuff out there that we don't really know about. We're always finding new stuff. They found the megamouth shark. Have you ever seen a picture of one of those? It's a very large shark from deep down, a glow-in-the-dark mouth. The way they found it, it got snagged in a sea anchor off of a Navy ship off of Hawaii in the 1980s. So there's lots out there, and there's actually a science. There's a science about everything, right? There's actually a science called cryptozoology, the science of hidden animals. So a lot of what I'm going to be talking about tonight relies on the science of cryptozoology. I think a lot of the life that we do know about is mind-boggling. This is a small tropical coral reef fish called an orbiculate cardinal fish. And I think this fish looks like it was designed by a committee. Someone wanted spots, no stripes, bright red eye. It's got it all. So even the stuff that we do have on our planet that we know exists is still pretty baffling and raises lots of questions. Like, what possible function could that have? Well, the truth of the matter is, when you see one of these fish in its natural setting, which is against living corals and all sorts of other gaudy coral tropical fauna underwater, it actually does blend in. It'd be hard to see this fish if it weren't in this photograph against these bleached corals in the background. Which brings us, nice little intro there, to the subject of Sasquatch or Bigfoot. We could say those are two names for the same thing. and tonight we're going to try to look at some of the evidence, sifting through whether Sasquatch does exist or doesn't exist. I'll tell you right off the bat, I'm a fence sitter on this matter. And if I say Sasquatch doesn't exist and someone finds one tomorrow, well, gosh, I'd be wrong, wouldn't I? So I'm not going to say that. I'm going to let you all kind of decide for yourselves. We'll look at some of the evidence. And in the mid-1990s, I wrote a book called Field Guide to the Sasquatch. I joked at the time, it's like a 40-some page booklet. And Field Guide to the Sasquatch, in my mind, it sort of combines everything we know about the Sasquatch into 48 pages. It seems to me that when people write about Sasquatch, they have to write really big, thick books. I've yet to see skinny books other than my own on this subject. So we're going to investigate a lot of the findings from that book. And when I look at Sasquatch, this is, of course, a drawing based on a lot of different eyewitness accounts and some photos and what have you that we have out there. We're talking about an 8-foot-tall creature. And hang on while I grab something out of my bag. Because I want to read to you the description of what the Army Corps of Engineers said about the Sasquatch in the 1960s. I love this. Here's the official, we're talking about government-authorized description of Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And this was in Appendix D of the Washington Environmental Atlas that was written by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And according to that document, the Sasquatch is an ape-like creature standing between 8 and 12 feet tall, weighing in excess of 1,000 pounds and taking strides of up to 6 feet. You wouldn't miss that if you found one of those in the woods, would you? Reported to feed on vegetation and some meat, the Sasquatch is covered with long hair, except for the face and hands, and has a distinctly human-like form. Sasquatch is very agile and powerful, with the endurance to cover a vast range in search of food, shelter, and others of its kind. This is a government document. A lot of speculation, but that's what they're saying. It's apparently able to see at night and is extremely shy, leaving minimal evidence of its presence. So that's the official description of the Sasquatch. But the same document, which was written in the 1960s, mind you, says, if the Sasquatch is purely legendary, the legend is likely to be a long time dying. On the other hand, if the Sasquatch does exist, then with the Sasquatch hunts being mounted and the increasing human population, it seems likely that some hard evidence may soon be at hand. Well, here we are 50 years later, and that hard evidence is still being sought. Which makes one wonder whether we're really talking about Higgins fur-bearing trout. hard to say. This is actually one of those novelty postcards. You know, I have, as my wife will attest, I have a vast collection of weird stuff in our house, and this is one of the things I love to collect, are weird postcards. So I don't think I'm willing to go to court that the fur-bearing trout exists. Because we need more evidence, right? Okay. As I mentioned earlier, there are lots of books written about Sasquatch or Bigfoot, two names for the same thing. And this is one I really like. This is a book that was written quite some time ago by science writer Ivan T. Sanderson. He's actually won a lot of awards. He's not just a hack. He's written this really thick book. And this book is kind of a survey of all the cultures around the world where they believe that a creature like the Sasquatch exists, whether we're talking about the Yeti, the abominable snowman, or the Matlocks of the North. Just about every culture has some reference to this kind of a creature, this large ape-like creature. We haven't really been able to nail down and identify. This is a picture that I find really fascinating. It was taken in the 1920 by a Swiss geohydrologist who was working in Guyana in South America. And his crew of surveyors were being followed and harassed by this creature. This creature is about 4 feet tall. And eventually, this creature actually got close enough that it started throwing things at the crew. And, you know, being a Swiss crew in 1920, well, what would you do? They pulled out a gun and shot it. And took this photograph. It's the only one that they know exists, the photograph, that is. The body they couldn't transport because they were in the middle of the tropics and not anywhere near an easy port, nowhere to put salt on this body and carry it around. So they left it, so the story goes. And the puzzling thing is there are no large apes of this style in South America, not that we know of. So what is it? You tell me. I don't know. It's one of those great mysteries. You can see this came right out of one of those Mysteries of the World books, because I just had to throw it in there. I like this picture. Some people would say our own cultures have these references. And, you know, Native American culture, lots of them have sort of wild man of the woods stories. In fact, the word Sasquatch actually came from a group of Native Americans that lived up in British Columbia, not that far north of here, around Harrison Hot Springs. And their stories were recorded by a reverend in the late 1800s, put into print, and they're talking about this creature. Well, we've kind of turned into Sasquatch. I think their word was more like Saskavich, something different. But when we transcribe a non-written language, we can only go so far. Some people would say that those stories are actually to keep kids closer to the campfire at night. For all you kids in the audience, that's what I'm hoping this lecture will do for you, too. So they're saying, oh, it's just purely mythology. There is no such animal. It's just one of those boogeyman kind of stories. A lot of other people, and I really like this one, Cain and Abel, right? A lot of people say most cultures have this whole thing broken down where we have sort of the crude, coarse, and hairy person, and we have the refined person. I mean, you see that in our own culture a lot. And everybody has a story. I think it's sort of a way of justifying our own kind of coarse existence. Like, you think we're gross? Check out this guy over here. But we have to have something that's even worse off than we are as far as a presence on our planet. So yeah, Cain and Abel, we have a lot of those stories in our own culture that we can draw on where the refined man is encountering the unrefined man. Probably the greatest thing that we have going for in favor of the Sasquatch are lots of witnesses. People who say, I've seen him. This is a guy I met. He lives in Bremerton, Washington. His name is John Christman. He's a retired electrical engineer. And originally, he says, he started going out elk hunting on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington. When he'd go out, periodically, he'd find these footprints. Big footprints. And he started making plaster casts of them. And eventually, he found enough of them that he said, it became like an excuse, I'm going elk hunting, but he was really looking for footprints. And then after that stage went on, he actually realized if he keeps making casts like this, he's going to need a larger house. He had more of them than he could actually store. So he stopped making casts and started going out looking for a Sasquatch. He never would find one on his journeys. But he'd find these footprints in areas that were pretty much off the beaten track. It wasn't like someone said, well, I'll put a footprint out right in front of, on the main drag here in Holden Village, and when people wake up in the morning, they'll find it. These are in remote areas where the chances of finding them might be next to nothing. So he was pretty convincing to talk to. It was also, for me, really interesting. He's not trying to get onto the Conan O'Brien show or, you know, get a grant to write his story. In fact, he's actually opening himself up to a lot of ridicule. So it was interesting to me that he had such a presence and such good stories. It didn't strike me as the kind of thing that one would just invent these I seen them stories for, you know, no reason at all. The footprints themselves are probably the greatest and most convincing evidence we have. This is an illustration from my field guide to the Sasquatch, and it's showing just by comparison what a bear's footprint might look like, what a human footprint, Sasquatch, and a gorilla. I don't think we're going to find too many gorilla footprints in here in the Northwest. So let's rule that one out. But I would say that a lot of what people think our Sasquatch footprints are actually bear footprints, not even necessarily grizzlies, maybe black bears. They certainly look similar to a human footprint if you look at them that way. But notice that the grizzly bear has claw marks, because they have lots of very large claws and on their feet, and those do leave marks in impressions in the dirt. Look how much larger this Sasquatch footprint is than a human footprint. I read that if a Sasquatch were actually fitted for shoes, they'd be wearing size 21. So pretty large stuff. There's some justification and logic in an animal that's weighing 1,000 pounds is going to need to spread that weight over a large surface area. So that's probably why the foot, it's almost like a snowshoe-sized foot, to be able to support all that weight. The thing that's interesting about the casts that they find when they make these impressions, pour plaster into a footprint left by a presumed Sasquatch, a lot of times they show great detail. It's not like someone just went out, took plywood and sawed up a little shape and tried to stomp around wearing these plywood footprints. They actually see dermal ridges, you know, the equivalent of fingerprints or footprints in this case. They can actually see that. In some cases, they've even found footprints of what appeared to be a deformed Sasquatch. And one Sasquatch investigator actually has one that he's convinced probably had polio or some kind of viral disease that actually stunted its growth. But they're very exacting in a lot of cases. They're not easy forgeries.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I have actually seen a footprint like that.
And where did you see it?
If I know you were going to be here, I would have brought the picture of it.
Oh.
It was way up in Canada. We were on our sailboat. It's about 35 years ago. And we were walking up an old logging road. There were only two boats in there. And we were walking probably a mile up the road. And all of a sudden, my son stopped and said, Bigfoot. And he was this huge footprint on the side of the road where it was kind of dry. That kind of dusty, dry dirt. And so we all looked, and we turned around, and we ran back.
Yeah, right. Nice.
And so there was another boat there, and he said, oh, it was probably a grizzly. So he went up with us, and he said, no, that's not a grizzly.
Wow.
And it was so remote that I don't know why anyone would go up there and try to make a footprint like that.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. And it seems we're kind of running our mock trial here today. I have to do my best Rod Serling impersonation and say, submitted for your consideration. Was it or wasn't it? Okay. No, that's really true. Footprints are probably the largest, most convincing evidence that something like this does exist. I think, and the very fact that you're finding them, we have one person in this room, the very fact that they're found in these really remote areas where it's, you know, what was the likelihood of your going on a walk that day and seeing that footprint? Hard to say. Well, the other thing we have in the way of large proof, whatever, evidence, let's say, are eyewitness reports. I didn't actually have the photograph, so I thought I'd throw this picture up here. This is a drawing done by a fairly good illustrator based on what is known as the Bluff Creek sighting. And I'm sure you've all seen these photographs, and maybe even film strips. They were taken in, I think, 1967 by a gentleman named Roger Patterson and Peter Gimlin. And those little bits of black and white film footage, you know, 8mm camera, taken in Bluff Creek, Northern California, have been analyzed to death. It's almost like the Kennedy assassination footage. People are experts frame by frame on what you're seeing in there. There's been all sorts of debate over whether that footage is real or whether it's a guy in a suit. We don't really know. Hard to say. So the other thing we have are, I would say, some credible eyewitness reports. People like that gentleman we saw before, Mr. Christman, who don't have a lot to gain and do have a lot to lose in terms of their own believability by crying wolf, who have come forward. In some cases, in one case on the Olympic Peninsula, right up by the Pacific beaches, was a policeman driving his car home late at night, practically drove the car into a ditch to avoid hitting this creature that ran across the street. You know, that's kind of a convincing one right there, unless he was maybe out drinking and wanted to cover up his, why does he have that bruised fender on his car? I don't know. And this Bluff Creek story is really fascinating to me. It has pros and cons to it. On one hand, it's actually some pretty accurate and detailed and, you know, tracking. I'm always amazed when people find something extraordinary, whether it's a UFO or a unicorn or whatever, their camera doesn't work, or they're out of film or whatever. This is actually some pretty lengthy film footage of this thing hustling its way through the forest in California. The disadvantage is that the Roger Patterson, the man who took this film, was out looking for Sasquatch and had been for quite some time. He even wrote a book about, does the abominable snowman of America really exist? So he's sort of obsessed with this topic. He then went on to sell the exclusive rights to the film footage of this to three different people. Doesn't sound good. And when people say, you know, it's real, then some people say it's not real. And the biggest argument, and boy, I hope no one ever uses this argument on me, they say it must be real because he wasn't sophisticated enough to make a fake. He is basically a cowboy kind of guy from Eastern Washington. So I don't want people to say that about me. That would not be a good thing. Roger Patterson died while this film was still being disputed. It's actually, there's a big, part of the reason I'm not showing pictures today, there's a big dispute over who actually owns the rights to that footage. And I don't even want to go there. A lot of Sasquatch researchers are very contentious and love to have the inside track on things. We don't want to get into a big battle over that. So it's better to show a drawing. I think even the drawing went through some bit of, you can't do that, we own the picture. So that's the thing, there are lots of good stories out there, but somehow some of those stories don't hold water, and some of them are not easily explained away. This is my favorite Bigfoot picture. This was taken in Sequim, you know, Sequim, Washington, that's out there on the Olympic Peninsula, up in the northern corner of the Olympic Peninsula. And when this photo was taken in the 1960s, it was after two hunters were out looking for grouse. It was a misty day. They saw Sasquatch. They freaked. They stopped hunting. They went home, told everyone what they saw. For several days, there were sightings of this creature in the community around Sequim. And then eventually the fog lifted, and this is what they saw, a burned out stump. Darn, I hate when that happens. So for every one of those really good, you know, the stories that raise the hairs on the back of your neck, there's probably three of these kind of stories where in some cases there are missightings of bears walking on their hind legs. They can do that. In some cases there are logs or something that looked really good but wasn't. Might have even been another hunter. Okay, scientists, one of the things that's fascinating me is scientists have actually figured out the what they would call the family tree of primates. You know, that would include people. And way up at the top, we're really looking at the representatives of the great apes. You know, it's not a very large family tree here. We have the orangutan, we have Homo sapiens, people, gibbons, chimpanzees, and gorillas. Now, going down here, we have earlier branches on that tree, Old World monkeys, those would be African monkeys, New World monkeys, South American ones, and these prosimians, we call those lemurs, right? So that's a very small number of animal types to be looking at. Along the way, there are lots of dead ends, too. You know, we actually lived, coexisted at times when there were other forms of humanity out there, Neanderthal man, for example. They show that they actually occupied, the Neanderthals, from looking at fossils, actually occupied some of the same caves that the Homo sapiens forebears occupied. There was some overlap at one point in history. And some people even suggest that what we see is actually kind of ancestral memory from days when we weren't the only ones calling the shots on this planet. But we're not talking about a really complicated family tree. So like when I showed you that picture from the 1920s in Guyana, you know, we pretty much know all the monkeys that are living in South America, or so we think. It makes something like an unexplained primate stick out. I wanted to take a great sidetrack because I was thinking about this day. I went out with the Narnia guys on a beetle hunt. We found lots of little black beetles. And I was thinking about this great quote from J.D. Haldane. He is a British scientist. Do you know this one? He was a scientist, and they asked him, he was really into genetics. They asked him, from the scientific evidence, what can you really tell about God? And Haldane said, well, God, if there is one, has an inordinate fondness for beetles. And that's because there are more species of beetles than any other form of life, living life on our planet. I love that quote. So he did not have an inordinate fondness for primates because there's just not this enormous diversity. It's pretty limited, as you can see here. Okay, there's actually one scientist who has actually come out and put forth this notion, knowing that the number of primate possibilities are limited. He's actually put out this notion that what we're seeing is a living fossil of Gigantopithecus. That's this big jaw right up here. This little jaw down here is a human jaw, lower jaw. And Gigantopithecus may have existed during a time when our forebears were running around, so maybe we have a little bit of ancestral memory there in a lot of those stories and tales we talk about unrefined man versus refined man. But this animal was enormous. It may or may not have walked erect. Some people say it was actually related to the orangutan, which we would call a knuckle walker. You know, when you see a gorilla walking along, they're not really walking erect. They're actually walking on all fours using their knuckles as support. Hard to say. You can actually look at these skulls and skull fragments and really determine a lot, like just the positioning of the jaw, whether it's designed to fit erect on the top of the vertebral column or whether it's just kind of designed to fit ahead of that, which would kind of be a four-legged approach. So Grover Krantz, and some people here in the room I've actually talked to earlier, had studied with Grover. He was at Western Washington University, I believe. No, excuse me, Washington State University. Wrote this paper, gave Bigfoot its scientific name. That's pretty much the stamp of scientific approval to give it a scientific name. Gigantopithecus blackii. That's the scientific name that he applied. Based on its presumed resemblance to the fossil remains of Gigantopithecus. Well, the fossil remains are not that great. They're like three partial jaws and a few tooth fragments. So to me, it's kind of like naming me off of my car keys. You know, we can assume I had two legs to push the gas pedal and the brake, right, and the clutch. Or that I had arms that were allowing me to turn the wheels. But pretty scant evidence and kind of a leap of logic. And I bring this up now because, unfortunately, my own experience looking at the science, I don't consider myself Stephen Jay Gould, you know, but looking at some of the scientific evidence, there's a lot of tendencies for leaps of logic. And whether Sasquatch actually existed or not, I wouldn't always want to jump to conclusions. everyone kind of wants to go, well, where's the body? That's the big mystery before a Sasquatch. In order to actually describe something and give it a scientific name, you really need what's called a type specimen. You need one actual specimen of this animal on which all descriptions are based. That gives it its genus and its species and its place in, you know, the scientific literature. We don't have that for Sasquatch. I do want to remind you of this one. This is the line that cryptozoologists love to bandy around, that absence of evidence is not evidence of an absence. In other words, just because we don't have a specimen doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And there have been lots of examples. I mentioned those ones early on about the megamouth shark. People didn't know it existed. The okapi. Have you ever seen one of those? They're zoo animals. They look sort of like a cross between a horse and a deer. The natives of the Congo had all sorts of reports of sightings of this creature. They even found a hide long before they actually found a living organism there. And until they actually had one, of course, Western science did not believe it existed. Same thing is true with the mountain gorilla. So when we look through our history of did it exist, does it exist, finding that specimen is really going to ultimately resolve everything. It opens up all sorts of ethical questions about if you did find a Sasquatch, well, what would you do? Shoot it and bring it into the laboratory? Would you put it in a zoo? I mean, I've read long papers discussing what the ethics of that would actually be. So I want to sum up a little bit about where we're at. I feel like this is sort of like what closing arguments here. In favor of the Sasquatch, we have credible witnesses. We have those convincing footprints. And I put a question mark after this one. I talked to a number of people who say they found hair samples and scat samples, fecal samples, from the Sasquatch. Now, a lot of times when I say, and then what happened? You found hair samples. Did you submit them for analysis? They were like, well, it was too expensive. Or yeah, but they used it all up and we didn't get the report. Again, it was sloppy science to basically say that and not actually have any convincing one way or the other. There are lots of misidentifications, and there was a great controversy over whether someone actually had an abominable snowman scalp from the 1950s that was acquired from some Tibetan monks. Well, that turned out to be a bear fur scalp, so hard to say. So that last one, I'm going to put that in a little bit of a question mark on there, whether we actually have that to go on or not. And now, let's bring the prosecution out. Those bogus biological assumptions, that kind of drives me crazy that people can make these leaps of logic and, you know, make sort of ill-founded claims. Every one of those pretty much drives the argument back 10 yards. So when people come up with this, that's a bad thing. Likewise, this history of hoaxes, that there are people that have actually been, there are a lot of deathbed confessions. The actual term Bigfoot itself came from an incident also in California where a road crew kept finding these big footprints around their machinery, you know, and they come back to work the next morning. In fact, in one instance, one of the machines was turned over. Well, more recently, there was a deathbed confession that was all a fake. Someone just wanted to have fun with their road crew to the extent that they even pushed over one of the road machines to show it could be done. So those also push the argument of whether Sasquatch exists. That's another 10-yard loss on that one. And that whole thing of where's the body? It's kind of a real mystery. It's a wonderful conversation to have here in Holden Village, in Lutheran camp. Where's the body? I'm not going to base my faith on where's the body. So whether you believe or not, that's one thing. In the terms of classical science, you're going to need to produce some kind of proof, some actual firm evidence there. And it's unfortunate that we don't really have any relics or remains. My biggest argument, after reading all this stuff, is we're talking about an animal that walks erect, right? And we always are taught one of the great advantages, one of the enormous leaps in our own human development came about when we started walking upright, freeing our hands and our opposable thumbs to manipulate tools. Well, they're not finding tools left over from the Sasquatch or any other cultural remains. You can find flintknap tools, you know, tools that have been carved out of stone, just about everywhere. They're all over the place. They're actually an easy fossil if you know what to look for, easy find. But we're not finding any relics or anything like that. The people that actually do, are the proponents of whether Sasquatch exists, will say that, well, they bury their dead. They're secretive. Bears actually, they say bears go off into caves and die deep, far back into caves. And boy, I've certainly seen a lot of fossil cave bear skeletons that kind of get lend credence to that notion that they're not just dying in front of everybody. So that's one of their justifications. But, you know, I really don't understand why we're not finding more stuff. The other one I think that's really important is the bogus biological assumptions. We're not just talking about one or two animals. In order to have a self-sustaining population, we need large numbers of these creatures. Otherwise, we basically have kind of a dead end. You know, 10 animals interbreeding is not going to create any genetic diversity. So I'm thinking we're talking about populations of more in the hundreds. And if they're out there and eluding people in those large numbers, that's a real accomplishment. I'm going to give you one more on the other hand. On the other hand, I remember reading about a study that was done in the North Cascades. They were looking at the grizzly bear, and based on the assumption that these bears, which had long been exterminated from our part of the Cascades, from the United States, were coming down from Canada and repopulating some of their historic ranges. So they had field biologists, lots of them, out there trying to survey the bears. Well, during this 6-year study, they found bear scat. They found areas where the bears were clawing at logs looking for termites and other food, but they never saw a bear. So I have to say, if a bear could elude trained field biologists for 6 years, a large intelligent primate could probably do that too. That's the concession I'm going to give to why haven't we seen them. The last thing I really want to say is another one of those great postulates from critical thinking. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. If you say, I was out last night, right after Vespers, and I saw a bright light in the sky, well, you don't need to prove that. That's pretty simple. If you were out and said, you know, I was walking down the road and I saw a UFO, you better come up with some good proof for that one. That's an extraordinary claim based on the fact that you saw that bright light. So summing up from my perspective, if you've seen the evidence so far and you've seen the finite number of primates that are out there, you weigh the pros and cons, and then you see something moving in the forest and say, it's Bigfoot, let's get some extraordinary proof there, okay? All right, I'm going to actually open the podium up to the rest of you, because I know you all have some stories, some of those I've seen them, and also some questions. It's hard to cover an entire book in 45 minutes. So, yes, sir.
Well, how do you explain all those commercials then on TV where this...
Oh, yeah. You know, that's a really good one. And one thing I really love, I was asked this on a radio interview not too long ago. You know, what is our fixation with this wild man of the woods? He's become iconic for life in the Pacific Northwest. Or for that matter, he's like the voice of the wild, period. We like to see those mysteries out there. We like to believe that we're not alone. We also, for that matter, a lot of us like to believe that we don't know everything. So it kind of is a wonderful thing to make this icon. Someone said to me during lunch, the two great mysteries in the Northwest are Sasquatch and D.B. Cooper. They're similar. So that's one thing that I like to point out, that there's sort of the mythology of that. And bear with me once more while I dig into my bag here, because I came across a wonderful quote today that I'd like to share with you, assuming I can pull it out of my bag. And this quote is from John Steinbeck. We all like John Steinbeck, right? sorry, let me fumble here. It's worth the wait. All right, here we go. This is in his book, Log from the Sea of Cortez. Have any of you read that book? You know, Steinbeck wrote nonfiction as well. In fact, he has a sea slug named after him because he used to go out on these scientific expeditions. So not all of his books are fiction. This one is about going out onto the Sea of Cortez in Mexico with a marine biologist. And he says in it, men really need sea monsters in their personal oceans. He says, an ocean without its unnamed monsters would be like a completely dreamless sleep. To which my friend Kari said, boring. On a dreamless sleep, that is. So I think in a way there's something about our own personal psyche where we need mystery. That's why we're all here looking at mystery, right? We need that. In the world of biology, the greatest mystery is, are we alone in the animal kingdom, or could there possibly be something else sharing the throne up at the top here? Anyway, let's have some questions. That was a long answer. Yeah.
What got you interested in learning about this?
What got me interested in Sasquatch?
Yeah.
Well, I've always been interested in unusual nature. I think I talked during my talk yesterday about cockroaches, that everyone knows bald eagles and orca whales are wonderful, right? But they may not know that cockroaches and slugs are wonderful too. So very early on, I got into looking at some of the unusual things. And I was really fascinated with this realm of science called cryptozoology. I actually wrote an article based on an interview with a scientist at University of British Columbia about all the sea monsters that are in the Pacific Northwest. At the time, I was writing a lot about ocean science. And it was fascinating to me, this enormous log of sea monster sightings that we have up here. Haven't been explained. For some reason, it seems a lot more logical to me that we'd be hiding, that we'd be missing large organisms that live in the oceans, because the oceans are so vast and so deep, than we would be in the suburb of Bellevue, for example, where they have found Sasquatch footprints. So I got really fascinated in that whole world of cryptozoology. And that eventually led me to writing this book. It's not entirely coincidental that the publisher is called Sasquatch Books. So it was an easy sell for them. They needed a book that said Field Guide to the Sasquatch. And that's how I kind of got the contract to write it. But for me, the real fun of any of these projects is the research. My wife would joke about this, I get very sort of rabbinical about the level of detail. I like to study things and get further and further down into that. So taking a topic like the Sasquatch is a great opportunity to find all that, those fun facts and those, I feel a little bit like Columbo, to tell you the truth, trying to get to the truth in a thorny argument like that. Yeah, in the back.
So didn't I read somewhere that they're going to do, that some university is sponsoring a DNA study of Sasquatch samples, and that if you have a sample, you should send it to them? I know I've read that in the press in the last, I'd say month or 6 weeks.
Gee, I haven't heard that, it seems perfectly likely to me. There have been a lot of really high-tech attempts to determine whether Sasquatch exists, including all these like helicopter surveys and night vision, and now there's a TV show, Sasquatch, Bigfoot Hunter at the time, reality TV. If you're on reality TV, now we're talking real stuff, right? Yeah. So it wouldn't surprise me. The biggest thing is, because I know this from working as a biologist, there's always that issue of chain of custody. You can't just take samples and use them all up in research. It actually has to go, and you have to be able to document that what you submitted stayed the same all the way through, came out at the end. If someone wants to go back and look at it again. And most of the time, that's done very poorly. There's, you know, that we used it all up, or I don't know what happened to it, or Fred said they were going to take it. But to me, that's like the chain of custody has been so violated, it's like laughable. And so if there is a university or a major effort like that to take that seriously, I'm all for it. DNA analysis has gotten progressively less expensive. It used to be prohibitively expensive, and now there are lots of ways that they can get around that. So if that's happening, I'm all for it. Anybody else? Yeah.
Is there a Sasquatch hotline?
There have been from time to time, you know, 800 Bigfoot numbers. But those are all run by foundations. I actually had a wonderful time interviewing a gentleman who had actually been on one of the original Abominable Snowman hunts. He got a very large research grant. He was British, so if anything he said sounded more intelligent than anything. He wore a safari coat and an ascot, very dramatic. And he ran a Bigfoot hotline for a while. But eventually the money runs out and the phone line goes out. I want to ask everyone, my turn to ask questions, how many of you have been in a situation where you think you've either seen, heard, smelled, or seen footprints of a Bigfoot? Well, get out there, folks. I've talked to a number of people who have good stories, but it's hard to figure whether they're good stories or mis-sightings.
I think it was the Forerunners video or DVD, and they said that in the early history of Holden, what they did is somebody dressed up like Sasquatch and met the bus of guests. Sasquatch kicked the driver out, and he got in and drove the bus up here, and then got out and disappeared.
You know, if it's going to happen anywhere, it would happen anywhere. That's a good one.
It happened at the J Charm student groups a year ago. I was there when the church was picking.
Wow. Now that's a convincing argument. But I want to know, was it a manual transmission? Because that would be difficult. Yeah.
You talked a lot about Washington. How many areas of the world have there been evidence or sightings over?
Well, it's almost like wherever there's a wilderness, you're going to find those stories. And the Russian Siberian region is full of Sasquatch legends and stories. They also have indigenous peoples that are very similar to Northwest people. You know, if you think about the Bering Land Bridge, the cultures are not that different. But there are lots of stories from the Siberia, and also from the Ural Mountains, where they've seen where supposedly a Russian general was traveling with a bunch of people, and they found these people called the Almas. They were some like a primitive race of people. They actually had kind of two close encounters with them. There are stories in South America. They're pretty much everywhere where there's wilderness regions. That's why I think the wild man of the woods is a really fitting description for what we're talking about here. It's like the spirit of the wild, basically. But they've also seen, in surprising incidents, of these footprints being discovered in residential areas. Every now and then I see stories about, you know, sort of small town America where Bigfoot-like creature is sighted, or where they find footprints. And I mentioned, just kind of in passing, they actually did find a pair of footprints, like, you know, a big Sasquatch and a little Sasquatch wandering side by side through a subdivision in a suburb of Seattle. Who knows? It's perplexing. Well, thank you all very much.